A new social media campaign is targeting celebrities who haven't spoken out against what's happening in Gaza. But is it working?
The sort of block out movement is a lot more about the shifting attitudes towards celebrity than it is about really achieving anything. Because yes, Kim Kardashian has lost followers, and there are some cases where celebrities are seeing a dent. But I think this movement misunderstands how traditional celebrities make most of their money.
I'm Taylor Lorenz, and we'll be talking about the celebrity blockout this week on Power User.
All right, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Waveform Podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Marquez.
And I'm Andrew.
And in today's episode, we've got a bunch to talk about. We've got Samsung's beefy new tablet over here, the S8 Ultra. We're going to talk about this. We also want to talk about YouTube subscribers and if they're still worth anything. And also, we'll get into Zach, Jerry, everything, snapping a phone in half. But yeah. First, we interrupt the regular programming to talk about Daft Punk.
We do.
Just like Daft Punk interrupt our regular programming at the studio.
Really messed
and had us
up.
All glued to our screens. It was kind of funny. Actually, this unfolded a little bit before the announcement, because I remember it was maybe like 3 or 4 days ago, Madian on his Instagram story had a picture of a Daft Punk Frisbee. Oh. And I just replied like fire emoji, and it's just like a random piece of merch that he had or whatever.
Yeah.
And then
last night, or the night before, I guess, this launched, Austin just randomly tweeted,
yeah,
I miss Daft Punk.
Exactly. And so this was all sort of just happening in the background. I'm just thinking about Daft Punk. And then out of nowhere, a Daft Punk Twitter account is born and tweets some album art from the Homework album.
From
1997. And we're all kind of like, what? This is, and it was like, it was a brand new account. It doesn't follow anybody. It wasn't even verified when it first tweeted. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to figure out, is this just, honestly, what I thought was, I thought Daft Punk finally retired the Twitter account and some lucky person just got it and started tweeting and trolling everybody. But immediately it's trending. There's an official DaftPunk.com website. The Instagram account lights up. It starts sharing images. It's given us throwback vibes. And then they tweet a Twitch link.
Well, they tweeted another picture first that was just like the I don't know if it was the poster or something from some concert in 97.
It was
like
tour,
the tour poster.
Yeah.
And people started freaking out about that.
Yeah.
And I think there was like, I mean, internally we saw that and then we saw Madian posting and all of us were like, imagine if Madian opened for Daft Punk.
We thought Madian was in on it. We thought he knew that Daft Punk was coming back and he was going to like be part of it with them. How great would that French duo or trio end up on stage? That would be amazing. But that's not what happened. We got our hopes up at least that high. That's not what happened. They tweeted a Twitch link, which was a countdown timer. Mm-hmm. And when the timer went up, it was uninterrupted footage of a 1997 concert, actually before they started wearing helmets.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
So a super OG original performance from Daft Punk, and they ended up re-releasing a sort of remastered version of the Homework album from 1997, 25th anniversary edition. I thought that was pretty cool. I wish they were touring again, but that's a whole other story.
At least it's not an NFT. A lot of people thought it was going to be an NFT, and it wasn't.
That was a relief. There was a brief thought for a minute in my head that we were going to see a Daft Punk NFT, and I would not know how to feel about that.
Would you buy an NFT of the... It was the silver robot that exploded, right?
Yeah. The closest I ever got to wanting to buy an NFT was a piece of Daft Punk art, actually.
It was Justin Mahler, right?
It was Justin Mahler.
Yeah.
And but I haven't actually bought any NFTs or really gotten involved very much. But I have my eye on them. They're on Twitter all the time. Mm-hmm. I was like, if Daft Punk gets into it, that's going to be crazy. But it wasn't. It was just a little innocent little remaster of an old album. So that was cool to see.
And you've been listening to it?
You know what's funny? So I listened to it on the way home that day in my car, and I am very familiar with pretty much Daft Punk's entire body of work, and so I'm listening to it in the car, and I'm like, oh, this does sound different. This does sound really good. Like, it's got this new spatial mix or whatever. I'm feeling like, oh, the bass is a little bit less distorted. It's a little tighter. I'm very into the difference here. But then I pulled it up on Spotify today, this morning at work. And I was going to play for you the difference between the two. And I played them, and I couldn't hear
you
a difference.
It's like you were having like a mental breakdown.
And I'm freaking out because I'm like, I know I heard a difference last night. It sounded very different. And now I'm playing the original Homework album back to back with the remastered Homework album, and they sound exactly the same to me. And I'm listening on the Yamaha speakers and the HD650s, and it turned out basically my car is introducing like the stereo mix. This is just what Tesla does. They just have like a standard amount of stereo separation they just create among their speakers. And so it was on by default. I had to swipe it down to off to have it sound a little more like I expected.
Okay.
But I was the victim of the placebo effect for sure last night because I was jamming. I thought this was all brand new stuff. It was, but it's good. I still enjoyed, you know, I got a little throwback out of it.
You'll have to listen. I'm sure there's some things that sound a little different.
I bet.
You hear remastered songs every once in a while, and just because you're so used to something, even if it does sound better or a little more full, it sounds off because you've just been used to something for so long.
Yeah, usually remasters, you kind of, you get a little more out of it. You get a little more, you know, highlighting some things you might not have heard before. You know, pulling up obviously higher resolution stuff, but just it would be like if I remastered an old YouTube video, you'd be like, oh, this new dynamic range, or it's a little more better resolution. I can't actually do that because I don't have the original footage. But anyway, that's the idea. So 25th anniversary of Homework, it's in the show notes, as if Daft Punk needs a shout out from me. Oh, I should have put the helmet on.
I think they're
on.
Doing a, oh, we forgot to do that.
Yeah, I was going
to
do the helmet.
We'll do our clips outro or something.
That's a great idea. Yeah. That's a great idea.
I think they're doing a vinyl release also of it.
True.
I believe.
Yeah, so if you're into the vinyls, definitely grab that.
I also have, I think everyone in the tech world kind of saw this video, but Jerry Rig Everything has been massive lately, but like it's when a phone fails spectacularly, his video is like the only thing on everyone's Twitter timeline in that sense. And we had one of those happen recently.
Yeah, he did the OnePlus 10 Pro.
Yeah.
And he snapped that thing in half like a candy bar, like
it
a
was
Kit Kat bar.
Really funny because Zach's intro, he was talking about how it's like, he was skeptical because it's a China release only phone when OnePlus never does that. And he was kind of like, let's see what goes wrong. And I know he does voiceovers, but that was in the intro part. And I was like, oh man, when he looked back to edit that, I bet he's so happy that he said that.
It was ominous.
Yeah. But watching through it, it just kind of does everything a normal phone does in his breakdowns. It was like scratches at 6, deeper grooves at 7, clockwork, like everything else. But then the bend test. And I also have to say there's a lot of comments every time this happens, which isn't very often, of who's going to ever bend like this.
Right.
No one. No one's saying anyone's going to bend it like this. You could put it in your back pocket. You could sit on it. There are ways, though, where a phone could break like this. And because he does it to all of his phones, when only... How many have snapped in half? 3, maybe?
I can think of 3 things that snapped in half.
3 things, though. Are all of them phones?
One was an iPad. Yeah. One was the Legion phone.
The Legion phone was recent and snapped in half. But we all thought the Legion phone was going to. Look at the design.
That was a weird one.
Thing.
It was also like not
it
built like a
normal
phone.
It snapped in 2 spots because of that. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the bend test thing is funny. I remember like the original... the genesis of the bend test, which was like the iPhone 6 Plus when Lou, you know, actually it started because there were articles about people who sat on the phone and in their back pocket it bent. And that was like, that's kind of funny. Like it's a brand new phone. It's just coming out. It's bending in people's back pockets. And then Lou was smart enough to do a video where he just tested like, well, I'll try to bend this phone. I don't know if he even tried to bend any other phones, but on camera, it's got the iconic top-down shot. The phone just bends right in half. And that was like a moment of like, well, that seems bad.
Yeah.
And so we got, you know, bend gate, Apple had to fix it. 6S has these reinforced pieces inside the phone. Zach's been doing bend tests since around then. And I think that's the thing people point to is most phones don't bend in half when you try that.
Exactly.
And the proof is Zach is very strong and tries really hard to bend all of these phones.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when one of them does fail that spectacularly, you're like, well, I wasn't putting my phone in my back pocket, but it does seem kind of bad that this phone so easily failed the
test.
Durability
wise, it is clearly weaker than the majority of other phones that he does. And that doesn't happen to.
Is that a deal breaker? If you were going to buy a phone and you saw that it failed the bend test, would that be a deal breaker for you?
I mean, if it's compared to another phone that I consider equal footing, that might just be the straw that that makes it change.
I really like the OnePlus 10 Pro in a lot of ways, and I feel like if it had the right software, or maybe the international version comes out and I really like it, I would still use it. I'd still be fine with
it. Yeah, I don't think it should severely affect anybody's...
And I don't use a case. Yeah. I just have it in my pocket.
True. I loved when he tried to put it in the case at the end to make sure the plug was still in there.
Yeah.
But it seems like there is a very specific reason it did it, because under that giant camera bump is basically there the space for the battery, and it's just like a clear space of nothing, a clear line across it of nothing. And then it happens to be on one side there's an antenna band, and on the other side there's the volume rocker, which is both of those things are making the rails, which he also mentioned really are super, super thin, not as stable.
Yeah.
So there you go. I mean,
it's basically the same problem Apple had, and they had to, in the next year's phone, specifically add reinforcements to have thicker pieces right around those thin parts of the rail.
I think even if the antenna band, volume rocker is probably in a spot it's always going to be, but antenna band and even thicker rails, if you make the antenna band closer to like where the camera module is or where the battery is, so you're getting a little extra support of the internals in it on something like that. But we all know Zach's strong, but it did not look hard to break that. I mean, first little bend and that the whole back was splintered and shattered. Yeah. And then just like he flipped it around and it was barely anything, and it just folded like a...
Also, the crazy thing is like he does this with bare hands, right? Yeah. So it's a glass phone. He breaks it in half. He's literally pulling glass out of his thumb as in on the camera. I've held up devices where I'm like, I wonder if I could bend this in half. But the second I like start to and I see the bend going, I'm like, no, I don't want to shatter glass everywhere and get it in my hands. Yeah. Like that doesn't seem fun. This tablet, which we're going to talk about in a second, guarantees Zach could snap this in half. He could snap it in
half. It's so big. So at a certain point,
it's much taller than an iPad Pro and it's thinner, and he snapped the iPad Pro in half. I don't see what they could do structurally to make this thing survive.
There's also...
But you never put it in your back pocket.
Exactly.
So it doesn't actually matter that much. Yeah. But yeah, that's what there's lots of phones out there that would be fascinating to try to bend in half, but I just leave it to the professionals.
Maybe we should do a studio Olympics of who can snap the most phones in half.
Didn't you snap the model phone in half
and
it shattered everywhere?
Well, that was more dangerous because of how much less safe that crappy glass is on like a model. That was glass everywhere.
It was glass?
Oh yeah, the front of it was glass. Oh. No, the front of it was glass and it was shattered everywhere. If you go back and watch that studio video of the phone guessing game, but yeah, and just real quick, why we're top of the show and still talking about Zach, he's doing this like EV Hummer build out.
Yeah, I've seen some of this.
I didn't really... There's 17 videos at this point, and they're insanely detailed, incredibly interesting.
So what is he doing? Because I've seen the final result videos and like sort of
he's
what
not
he's
totally
built.
Done
it's not
yet,
totally
but
done, but what is the... Explain what the concept is and what he's trying to accomplish here.
It's kind of funny when he explains the concept, because he's essentially taking one of the least fuel efficient cars possible and turning it into an electric vehicle, he called it the green machine. So it's a Humvee, so not exactly like a regular Hummer. And he explains in there that kind of the difference between a Humvee and a Hummer is like Humvee is a military vehicle that doesn't have the standard luxuries of like a regular everyday car, like air conditioning and pretty normal stuff. I mean, it's like almost straight metal interior, and there's a bunch of quirky little things going on with
this. This is like a 5,000 pound truck.
Is
like armor truck.
Yeah. And what I also, right in the beginning, the way he moves it into this garage is this like little armored tank Roomba looking thing that he like puts his jack on and it can push like 3,000 pounds or something.
What a great invention. But it pushes the whole Hummer. So it's
was really, really impressive.
Yeah.
But he's been doing everything from stripping the Humvee of all the regular, like the engine and the transmission and all that stuff. And then he's replacing it with the motor from one of those vehicles that pulls airplanes, essentially.
Mm.
And then he has a bunch of batteries that I believe were from like a Model 3 or something like that. I'm almost positive it was a Tesla. I don't remember the exact one.
Wow.
But he's building everything. I haven't watched every single video, but he gets super detailed and it's really, really fascinating. And I'm also really impressed by how he just like takes the camera underneath the car to like take apart all these different things.
It's a lot of work. It's funny, in the car community, it is fairly common to like take a built engine and use like built parts and do all sorts of custom stuff.
Yeah.
That doesn't really exist in the EV world. Like we have, I don't know if you've ever seen Rich Rebuilds.
I know of him, but I don't watch much.
It's kind of along the same lines where it's like you realize that these car companies don't want you taking apart their cars because there is so much complexity. You have to be an electrical engineer to make a lot of this stuff work safely, whereas you had to be a mechanical engineer to do a lot of the previous generation of car stuff safely. Mm-hmm. Now, you could get good enough as an enthusiast to do the car tinkering with gas cars. Zach's demonstrating how hard it is to do it with an electric car. Rich Rebuilds did a version in reverse, actually. He took a Tesla and has started gutting it and put a V8 in it.
Really?
Which is really funny. Half of it is like trolling because this guy is incredible troll. But like that's the type of stuff that you realize is very rare. So I think it's cool that Zach's doing it. It's not going to be like some like street legal production car type thing. He's just doing a project.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure what the legalities of it are.
I don't think it's supposed to be street legal or anything. I mean, it might be.
I'm not totally sure. I don't know what you would have to do to get it to be street legal. And I'm sure he talks about it in one of the episodes, but I watched like maybe the first five and then the last two. Mm-hmm. But highly, highly suggest watching it, especially now if you haven't watched it and then you want to like binge something. He's getting really close to the end of it.
The end of it.
I don't
want to
spoil anything. Just being complete.
Just complete. Yeah. You can drive it, park it, charge it.
I mean, not just like straight up like a short drive. I think he wants it to be like a regular daily driver.
I'd be curious what happens when you plug that into like an Electrify America charger. Does it just think it's a normal?
I don't know if that's even possible. Yeah, I'm sure he's also covered that. Like I said, lots of episodes, all of them are about 20 or 30 minutes. And I, now that I know about all of them, because he's been posting more recently. Mm-hmm. And then I found out he's been doing it since last July, I believe.
Yeah.
So
I wish him luck. Zach, good luck. Also, come on the podcast and explain
when
you're
done.
Doing.
Yeah. Watching this, I was just like, Zach needs to come on the podcast.
Yeah.
Soon.
Sick. All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about this tablet I could snap in half.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway.
And I'm Ed Elson.
And we're the hosts, the co-hosts. It's kind of unfair to call us co-hosts. I'm really the host. He's he's my Robin Givens. Let's just be clear on what this is. But anyways, we're the hosts of Prop G Markets, your go-to podcast for all things money. Every Monday, we provide brash, unfiltered analysis on market-moving news, high-flying stocks, growing sectors, stupid boardroom decisions, and master of the universe CEOs.
And on Thursdays, we speak with some of the world's greatest finance professors, Wall Street insiders, and industry experts to keep you informed without getting bored. So if you want to understand money and how you can get more of it, you have to talk about money, and we're here to help you do that. Follow Prof G Markets on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts to automatically receive new episodes every Monday and every Thursday.
That's right. The good news is we know how to get you economic security. The bad news is the answer is slowly. We'll tell you how on Prop G Markets.
Lifetime. Support for the show comes from Anthropic. Companies of all sizes are exploring use cases for AI and finding that it's not a one-size-fits-all game. It's all about finding the right balance between speed and intelligence. Like if you're powering a customer chat experience, you need instant speed at low cost. If you're doing complex R&D or advanced analysis, you need frontier intelligence. Claude 3 from Anthropic offers AI models for a variety of tasks and budgets. Claude 3 Opus is their largest and most powerful model that can handle complex tasks and analysis. Sonnet strikes the balance between information and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and most cost-effective model that can execute lightweight actions fast. Anthropic's dedicated to building AI systems that are reliable, interpretable, and steerable. Their multidisciplinary team of researchers, engineers, policy experts, and business leaders designed Claude to elevate the field of generative AI. See for yourself. Join the thousands of enterprises who use Anthropic to navigate this new frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude, C-L-A-U-D-E, today. Jumpstart your genius with Claude 3 by Anthropic. All right, welcome back. I'm holding in my hands, for the video viewers, you can see this, but for audio viewers, a Galaxy Tab S8 Ultra. I love that Samsung makes these. So we've had Samsung tablets in the past. I've made videos about a couple of them, and they've had the Galaxy Tab S7. We've had a couple of them in the studio and made videos, but this is an Ultra for the first time. So they have a Tab S8, mm-hmm. and they have a Tab S8 Plus. This is the Tab S8 Ultra. It is a 14 and a half, almost 15 inch screen.
I'm just going to hold up my Surface laptop next to it. It's
basically
smaller.
Basically imagine a laptop screen, but just a screen. So 15 inch laptop. It's about a 2.9K by 1.8K. So it's a decently high resolution, but there is a lot going on here that I'm curious what your thoughts are, because the gold standard in the tablet world is still the iPad, right?
Yeah.
And this is a $1,100 tablet, so it's competing with the highest end iPad, the iPad Pro, if you mm-hmm. were to compare it to another tablet. This does a lot of things the iPad would never do. So I think it's worth at least pointing at some of those things.
Yeah, for sure.
Talking about them. Number one, it's huge, and it's 16 by 10, which is interesting. The iPad has always been a little closer to a square, not quite a square.
Okay.
But it is very obvious when you're holding it that this is meant to be in landscape. It doesn't really make sense to use it like this.
So you're holding like a clipboard.
Yeah, that's probably about the same aspect ratio. I mean, you could read a web page like this, but mm-hmm. the way things are oriented, the way the notch at the top is in the top middle, and we'll talk about the notch, and the fingerprint reader is over here where your thumb would be. Boom.
Oh, okay.
So
in
this
display
is just,
fingerprint reader.
Yeah,
also,
it's got the, it's optical, it's not ultrasonic, but like it's just made to be horizontal.
For sure.
So that's an interesting note.
Although the power and volume rocker feel like what it would be like if you were using it portrait.
That is true, but then they're all the way at the top, which is interesting.
I mean, if you were just blowing a phone up, this is about where they would be.
True.
They'd just be a lot bigger.
But. Yeah. And then the port is down at where at the bottom would be too. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But I still think this is a horizontal experience
I
most of the time.
I agree.
Because this huge screen, what are you doing? Watching movies, gaming, I mean, watching any videos really.
Yeah. Potentially, I mean, multitasking stuff. On it as well.
Multitasking. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two is it's an OLED. And this is something I haven't seen in an iPad yet. So the iPad, you know, mini LED, we hear about all these dimming zones and that's all great. I think this looks better, even though it's a slightly lower pixel density, and I can kind of see a little bit of if I go.
I mean, it's a big enough screen.
Real
that's
close.
Your best chance at being. But if you're, again, if you're doing this, if you're like squinting
look
an
at
inch
the,
away.
Look at the text. Doesn't that look kind of soft? It's a little bit to do with the resolution and a little bit of the.
I see what you're talking about.
Of the pixel layout. I don't know if it's pentile or what this matrix is, but it does look a little soft. But look how close you are to it to see that.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Like if you're just looking at this any day, you're like, that's a beautiful screen.
Yeah. So it's a huge OLED, and this is the biggest touchscreen OLED. I think I want to confirm that, but I think it's the biggest touchscreen OLED I've ever used because we get the OLED TVs. But then we have lots of like mini LED laptops, mini LED iPads. This is a 15-inch OLED, and it looks great. Gets up to about 400 nits, a little bit dimmer than the max brightness I would have liked to have seen, but that's the downside of OLED is it doesn't get super bright, but great looking screen. So I definitely want to point that out. Expandable storage, that's
great.
That's nice. Micro SD card right at the top there, that's cool. And then this pen is included for free. So
oh,
it's
free.
It's an S Pen.
Free.
Definitely not something Apple's doing right now with the $130 pencil. But here's the interesting thing. It attaches two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One, you can attach it by a magnet to the top right there.
Okay.
That
seems
is like
reasonable.
It's reasonable. It doesn't charge there. So this is
seems
like
unreasonable.
Your this is like the take the tablet off, or like I was using the pen for a little bit and then I just want to leave it there for a second while I see how hard it is. Okay. I just want to leave it there for a second while I do one or two other things and then grab it again. So that's like a short term storage.
Or if it's
thing.
Like laying down flat and you're just sliding it right on top to keep it there.
So it's got that flat edge like the Apple Pencil. Okay. I gotta snap it into place. But the only place it actually charges is on the back, like that. And this is the same as the last year. Where it's super easy to just scrape it off, or if you put it in a bag, if
why
you don't have a case.
It, can I see?
Yeah.
Why is the place it goes on specifically glossy? That's just supposed to show you where it goes, or? Oh, because it's glass and can wirelessly charge through
it can't be metal. So they just decided to do plastic or whatever glass
that is.
It
feels weird to have like a glossy place where the thing that's going to like touch on it all the time and potentially scratch it up.
Yeah.
It's going to just constantly keep going.
The iPad does like a plastic, matte plastic cutout. You can only do it facing one way.
It kind of does it, but you can tell it doesn't
work. But it doesn't charge. Yeah.
Oh, it doesn't charge?
Not very well. Oh, you have to line it up pretty well.
A very specific spot that.
Yeah. Because when you do that, I see an animation. It's a nice click.
It's a nice click.
So that's one thing. I don't know if, you know, the iPad kind of has the same problem where like you slap the Apple Pencil on the side and it could just fall off at any point. Mm-hmm. Here's Samsung's solution. This is half of their book keyboard case. There's an attachable keyboard. The other half is just like, imagine a magnetic folio that slaps to the back that has a dent in it that just holds the pencil to the back of the tablet.
And essentially like has its own little flap so that you can open up for the pencil without taking the whole thing off of, it's like a little hidden compartment, except it's not hidden because it looks really obvious from the back.
Yeah, it's just a little bulge holding the pen in there.
Do you know who I think has done this the best? Microsoft. They have the keyboard that goes in the bottom, that's the front cover for it, and at the top of the keyboard, it just basically folds onto itself and creates its own little hinge and hides the pencil in there.
Right.
And then it doesn't feel like this huge bump on the back. It's just kind of like, well, you almost don't notice it because when the keyboard's up, it just props it up a little tiny bit, and then the pencil's hidden.
I do like that a lot. The problem with that is you can't use that without the keyboard thing.
I guess they're assuming you're using the keyboard as like you're just plain cover. But if you don't want to bring your keyboard, then you've lost.
Yeah, I like that this accessory, you can use half of it.
True.
And you can use this little kickstand right here. And Dave made a video about this tablet already. We're working on our full video right now. But mm-hmm. something he said in the video, which I thought was really interesting and very true, is a tablet this big, you aren't using it holding it most of the time. Like, it's got this split keyboard that I keep using because I'm typing while holding it, but I actually found most of the time I use it, I've set it down somewhere, and mm-hmm. I'm either watching something, or I have a website pulled up, I've got whatever, Amazon, whatever videos, and so I just use the regular keyboard, and so I've got this little kickstand here, and it just pops up like that, and then that's how I use it most of the time. I don't think I've taken my iPad out of the folio in years. Like, it just sits constantly in that folio case.
No, I do like this little kickstand's nice because it's not adding a lot of bulk to the back of it.
Yeah.
But
it's also the thinnest tablet I've ever seen. Yeah. So you can add like a thick case and it's totally fine.
It's a good hinge on this too for how thin it is.
Yeah. Now.
Oh man, I keep slamming it on the desk.
It still has the optional keyboard accessory that I'll hold up for our video viewers here. It's got a trackpad, it's got some pins and some magnets, and it slaps on. This has the same problem that the Surface and the iPad Pro have, which is that the top is heavier than the bottom. Uh-huh. So when you try to use it like a laptop, it's all flopping around because all of the weight, it's like top heavy basically. So you have to use the back. Yeah.
Oh, you have to use the stand, you're saying?
You have to use the stand. Yeah. So if I were to use this kind of like a regular laptop like this, there's no strength to this hinge at all.
Yeah,
it's just holding it.
You're almost, so like, because now you're putting it up a little higher, and the way the kickstand on the back of the folio works is it's only as long as the actual tablet is. When you bring it up, you almost have to be using this at like 120 degrees. You almost can't get it up at like 90.
Yeah.
Because now the kickstand isn't tall enough and it's messing it up.
Yeah.
And it falls over.
Exactly. it's kind of cool that you can have, the laptop setup is like a nice option. It's got DeX built in. There's a quick keyboard shortcut, switches it into DeX mode. It looks great, but yeah.
Biggest problem with this that I think a tablet needs to solve, and kind of the iPad Magic did it. What is it? The Magic Folio or whatever? What do they call it?
With the keyboard?
That floated and was supposed to feel more. You can't put this on your lap. When this is on your lap, it can't stand up because it needs a hard surface behind it for the kickstand to support.
Yeah.
So because of this, which is how I use my laptop so often, is it can't just use it right in my lap, which is a pain, and I don't know how you'd solve that.
Do you use your
that.
Laptop in your lap a lot?
When I'm using a laptop, yeah.
I guess it depends on the size of the machine. I hardly use my laptop in my actual lap anymore. I usually just carry it between tables and put it on a table.
I think there's times where I'll take it and I'd like to like be watching TV and doing something quick on my laptop or something like that, and then I'd like to sit on my couch and lean back rather than like...
Or like put it on the couch next to you. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think this would do great on a couch next to you either. It'd be real floppy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the downside. But I guess we should talk about the notch. I'll just bring up the notch real quick. Mm-hmm. I think this notch is the easiest non-issue of any notch. It's a tiny notch, smaller than the iPhone's notch, mm-hmm. on a huge screen, 15-inch screen. And it's holding two cameras right now, the standard 4K webcam and an ultra-wide 4K webcam. I really like these. These are really good quality webcams. The ultra-wide has this follow feature that works okay. It's not very responsive, but it works. So I like that it has an ultra-wide webcam. They're both too big to fit in these super thin bezels, so it's got a little tiny notch. I think it doesn't matter at all. Totally fine. I'm curious what you think looking at it.
My biggest issue, and it wouldn't be solved by putting the notch on the top in portrait mode, was just like at one point in one orientation when you're holding this, it's wrong. So like, I kind of think back to the, was it the second Mi Mix Ultra that had the cutout camera in the bottom corner?
Oh yeah.
Like I almost wonder what this would look like if there's just a little black space in this corner to have an extra camera or the two cameras. And then when you're holding it in portrait, it's just like in a corner based on portrait and landscape.
I guess the only thing about a corner webcam is that no matter what orientation you're in, the webcam is off center and you're not really looking at it. So like if you're on a video call like this is the best place for a camera for it to be up here.
Yeah.
But if I put it over to the side, like on the iPad, you're constantly looking over to the side of the webcam and it never really looks like you're looking at the camera. That's like kind of annoying. And I guess that's why I want the iPads to shift to this spot. A corner would just always be off. So I think that they did a good job.
I mean, that's like very, very nitpicky. I don't think it's that bad. One thing that I find really interesting with Samsung as a tablet and just Samsung phones in general, and it makes more sense to me on a tablet, is their DeX features. Like getting closer to this, where like this does feel pretty close to a laptop in all of this, and like how Chromebooks are so much more, I don't know what you're, oh, you're trying to
I was
to
trying to turn DeX on.
Okay. Like Chromebooks are becoming so much popular because we're realizing as people, so many average users are just using for websites and emails and stuff and YouTube and whatever. Yeah. Like this probably is more powerful than a Chromebook. And if you can just dock it into a station, this feels, it's Android, but mm-hmm. a Chromebook is Chrome OS. So like both of them are kind of losing
out. So powerful, you mean software wise?
I mean software for what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like both of these, a Chromebook and this can handle web browsing, YouTube,
yeah.
emails, absolutely no problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean the base, I don't know, I'm thinking like, you know, similar price range. If you got a $1,000 Chromebook, you'd have more
fair.
You'd have more $1,000
Chromebook is ridiculous.
But you're still doing the same stuff. It's just a web browser, right?
Sure.
So you know, I'm using this tablet and it to me still feels like a big tablet. So like mm-hmm. the Instagram experience isn't great. The SoundCloud app isn't really good. Like the columns and Gmail are pretty decent, but like my to-do list app doesn't take advantage of the space. Like it's not great.
Okay.
But it's fine. You get your windowed apps in DeX mode, which is cool. But yeah, I guess it does have a similar level of productivity to a Chromebook plus any extras that happen to work well with Android on a tablet.
Yeah, like if you're a journalist or, you know, a writer or something like that, and then this is really easy for you to lug around and take down some quick notes or draw some stuff up like in an Uber ride. And then when you go home and you're ready to really bang out an article and you need to like use your normal keyboard because typing a whole article on this keyboard would probably be pretty brutal. Then you can plug in your mouse and keyboard and have a monitor that maybe is a little more oriented for correct posture, something like that, a little more ergonomically correct. And that seems kind of neat.
Yeah. I'm not an artist, but I can.
You can scribble.
I can scribble for days.
I'm really also just like not a tablet person.
Oh, generally?
So it's like hard for me to really see who's fully taking control of this, but the more and more I look at tablets, the more and more I'm realizing they're at this part where there are people who don't do as many things on the computer and that probably could super benefit from this. And someone who travels, like, this would be awesome. That's the one time I consistently see myself being like, I wish I had a tablet, is watching movies like on the plane.
Yeah, that's a good question of like, I don't know if I should, maybe we can put some of this in the review, but what is the ideal workflow and like set of devices to have? Because I think there's a lot of people who have a really good computer and a decent phone, and that's all they need. A tablet in the middle wouldn't make sense. There's also a group of people who has a really good phone and like an okay computer, because the phone can do so much and it's got a big screen and it can do all kinds of tablet stuff that you don't really need a tablet there. And so there's a bunch of people who have like a phone they don't like as much, or a tablet, or a computer they don't like as much. But if they got a tablet that they really liked, it could do kind of both in a way. It could have the app experience. You could do the email, social media, watching videos, but also you could put a keyboard on it and start answering emails in like a long form type of way and like really do some serious productivity stuff. But I don't think anybody needs a good phone, a good tablet, and a good computer. So there's always like a balancing. Which one do you want?
I would say if this is your main thing, a computer is probably not something you're taking everywhere with you. And the person then that I would say that happens is someone who travels a lot and is still taking phone calls. So no matter how good their phone is, yes, you can multitask on phone, but no one likes to really do that much work on their phone.
You don't like the triple window action on the Galaxy
Note? No, and I don't like hearing people like tapping on the phone when they're like obviously doing stuff. So like this then to me seems like that kind of person. I don't know if that's like a trader or something like that who's traveling a lot, or like, again, a journalist who might have to take notes in a rough place and is also calling people pretty often for interviews or something like that. If you are somebody that this feels like would be your main,
if you're in the target demographic.
I kind of want to know the target demographic. Like we've heard people respond to us on why people do like the S Pen and phones, and there's been some really interesting that totally makes sense.
Yeah,
I would like to know how somebody would incorporate this into their everyday workflow or just everyday. Not mobile gaming. I totally understand that mobile gaming on tablets is far more fun than on a phone. But I find it hard to buy $1,000.
Yeah, for like every single day.
Yeah,
if for all like you do
PUBG
is game.
Mobile. Yeah,
fair. Yeah, no, I'm curious about that. But yeah, full reviews in the works. Obviously, I've been using it for a little bit. I don't have a full sense of battery life yet, but it seems pretty good. I want to put in a heavy day today and tomorrow and see what happens. But seems pretty good. Oh man, putting the pen on blind is not easy, but I got it. That's the Tab S8 Ultra. Also, people have been asking on Twitter about it. It's like, I didn't realize every time this comes up, I always get a bunch of people asking about the new Galaxy Tab and what I think of it and how good it is. So this Ultra speaks to me.
Last time we covered a Tab was in a video that had a sponsored bit, and people were mad that we didn't talk more about the sponsored bit. So like it was kind of here and there, but like no matter what, Samsung's products seem to get a lot of hype. And I think a lot of it is how close they are comparatively to Apple and forming a similar ecosystem. And I think people want choice. And this is, I mean, like even without using this so much, it seems like one of the obvious competitors against the iPad, and people want that competition.
Yeah, it's that, and it's the willingness to do things Apple won't do. You won't see a micro SD card slot in the iPad. You won't see, you know, Android, obviously.
Yeah.
You won't see an OLED as of right now. So yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that video.
Before we stop talking about this, I kind of want to, and these won't count towards the scores, or maybe it can count towards the scores with an asterisk. Let's do the alphabet typing test on this.
On this?
Yeah.
Oh my God. On the screen? Okay, so I got to use
it. Yeah, do the screen. Let's make this tough. I just think this sounds fun.
This is going to be bad.
This does not have anything to do with how good or bad this tablet is, but I'm just...
Here's another question. Do you want to try the split keyboard? Which is...
Probably the right way to do it, but
really,
well,
I'll give you the split. You can here. I'll pull it up.
I guess. Are you gonna hold it or are you gonna type with it like on the ground?
I'd be faster putting it on the table and poking.
You do one, I'll do the other. Which one are you doing?
I'll do full keyboard. You can do split keyboard. Yeah.
Damn it.
Here you go.
Okay.
Good luck. I'm gonna go with I'm gonna predict.
Can I screen record this?
I can screen record.
Yeah. If I get sub 10 within 3 tries, I'll be really proud of myself.
I was just predicting that you would get over 10. Okay. I was gonna say over 10. So if you get under 10 with a split keyboard,
oh my God, I'd be very impressed. I have to hold this.
Yeah.
This is.
Yeah.
You know what? This seemed big, and now like.
It's a
looking at it.
A
this
lot of
this
space.
Feels like I'm about to like go bungee jumping. It's like, yeah, that looks so cool on YouTube. And then you like look over the edge and you're like, I don't think I want to do this anymore. Yeah. Okay. I don't see the number. Hold on. I need to make sure I put the keyboard down without losing it.
Yeah.
7.6.
7.6?
Did you see how much my head had to
Yeah, you were looking back and forth between the right and the left
this
side.
This thing, for the audio listeners, this tablet is so big and was split keyboard to type the alphabet. I literally had to turn my head like left to right constantly to do
okay,
it.
Okay, now I feel like I need there's like pressure for me to beat that.
That's first try too. And the suspense is really there because you can't see the time because the keyboard comes up over it on the website. Standard keyboard.
Standard keyboard. Here we go. Ready?
Wait. I want to record this. I want to get the lack of ASMR in
it's not gonna sound
tapping.
Good.
You messed up like 3 times.
I did. That was pretty bad. 10.2. I messed up at what letter?
Like 2 or 3 of them.
I took 2 seconds to find the S button.
Well, it's because you missed it.
And I had to come back.
And then kept going and then came back.
Should I do one more?
Yeah, do one more.
Okay.
That's much better. 6.91. I was still, that's pretty close to each other.
That's impressive, man. Well done. Well done on the split keyboard. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about YouTube.
Okay.
It's loud, deafening, cacophonous.
It's a nightmare.
Oppressive.
And just what is it that many people think is pretty nightmarish and yet are still willing to shell out quite a bit of money for a night out at a restaurant?
Sound is the number one complaint that diners have about their experience. So why are restaurants so loud, and when did that start happening?
Is there anything anyone can do to fix it? We've got the answers on the latest episode of Gastropod.
All that, plus the science behind the perfect playlist to accompany your meal. This special episode is part of our new collaboration with the podcast Switched on Pop.
Find Gastropod and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
When was the last time you noticed a federal comment period? You know the type. Federal government is passing a law or changing a rule, and they want to hear what you think about it. Well, one of those comment periods just kicked off and runs for the next 2 months, and it's a big one. The federal government wants to know what you think about their plan to reschedule marijuana. Not what time you take your smoke break, Spicoli.
Sorry I'm late. It's just like this new schedule is totally confusing.
The federal government is basically trying to recategorize weed, and it could happen as soon as Election Day. The president says it's a big deal.
This is monumental.
But we reached out to a cannabis policy reporter at Politico to ask if she thought it was monumental, and she said yes, but also no. Our conversation is waiting for you at Today Explained.
All right, welcome back. I have, confusingly enough, a tweet about a LinkedIn post, but it kind of made a little wave on Twitter, especially in our group of creators. And I just wanted to talk about it because I think it's really interesting and I wanted to see your opinion on it.
Sure.
So Colin and Samir tweeted a post from someone named Ezra Cooperstein, I believe. So the post by Ezra says, the YouTube subscriber has long been the currency of the platform. It will be gone in the next 2 years or at least deprioritized. The algorithm is better at knowing your interests and knowing what you want to watch. And consequently, a sub will mean less and less. This is already the case on TikTok. It's time to think less about this number and more about metrics that do matter. And then Colin and Samir just said, like, if this happened, we'd be bummed. Getting to 1 million subscribers is something they've been actively shooting for a long time.
Right.
I have a few thoughts on it, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
So the YouTube subscriber count,
yes,
is a what they call a vanity metric.
Yeah.
Which is basically that it doesn't really mean that much anymore, although it is a nice like looking thing to have on your front door.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that will always be true. I think there'll always be a bunch, like when you arrive at a YouTube channel and you see that it has a bunch of videos, kind of the first thing you look at is, well, how popular is it? how many views are the videos getting?
Yeah.
How many subscribers does the channel have? It gives it a sense of legitimacy mm-hmm. to varying degrees. It's not like I see 3 million and think, oh, that's not as good as 5 million. But generally, if it has a lot, I think it's pretty legit. If it doesn't, then it's not, or maybe it's fake or whatever. So that's what like the vanity metric thing is to me. But I've also, you know, he brings up TikTok, which yeah. is a really interesting example. YouTube subscribers are very different from TikTok followers. I think they're worth vastly different amounts as mm-hmm. far as the way they kickstart you into the algorithmic boost. At yeah. least this is the way I view it, right? So I started a TikTok from zero. And one of the first things I posted when I had, you know, probably a 5-digit number of followers had like 1 million views. And so it was very clear that those people were not coming from my audience, they were coming from the algorithmic boost. It just yeah. got sucked up into, you know, people wanting to see this type of thing. That doesn't happen nearly as dramatically on YouTube. If you wanna see a video get to 1 million views, you need it to have some sort of an initial kick
yeah.
to get it into that algorithmic
yeah.
feed
mm-hmm.
to get it to people. And that comes from subscribers. That comes from the initial audience of when you first serve up the video. All those people serve as data points for YouTube to know, ah, turns out people like this video.
Yeah.
Because YouTube doesn't really want to take the risk. This is the difference between their algorithms. You know, YouTube doesn't really want to take the huge risk of going, let's serve this 15-minute video to 5 million impressions and see how many yeah. people click and watch it. But if you serve it to your subscribers and they click it voluntarily and they do like it, then YouTube already knows, oh, I can serve this up. So I think TikTok has
a really— it's like the control group.
Exactly. Yeah. So TikTok doesn't need that control group as much. They've got an amazing algorithm and they can figure yeah. out what's good about a video and what audience to serve it to, and they crush that. But I think YouTube specifically, I agree that subscribers are less important than they have been in the past, mm-hmm. but I don't think they will ever be completely meaningless.
I think you bring a really interesting point in the fact that like both, ultimately we know that both of these platforms are trying to keep a user on the site as long as possible.
Yep.
So in that, in trying to keep somebody on the platform, TikTok, while its algorithm is insane, we've talked about it all the time, but if it serves you a video you're not interested in, it's taken away 3 seconds of your time, because within a couple seconds, you know you don't like this and it's a quick swipe.
Yep.
If YouTube, so many more of those videos are 8 minutes, 9 minutes, 10 plus minutes, like you said, 15 minutes. If it serves you that and you don't like it, it's not just a swipe away. Then you're going to make some like choices around based on that. You're going to go search something else and you have way more of a chance of getting served a 15 minute video and being like, yeah, I think I'm done with YouTube for today, and closing the browser. Where
right.
TikTok, you get served a bad video, you just swipe. Not even if on TikTok you swipe backwards to leave, thinking you're going to close the app, it brings another one in and it has a chance to snag you again.
That's really true. So the mechanism for selecting a new piece of content is different.
Yeah.
And this is just disregarding YouTube Shorts right now. This is just like a standard YouTube
video.
Yeah. If I don't like a TikTok, basically, I swipe, it's no effort, it's 2 seconds, and it's already on to trying to give me the next best piece of content
yeah.
on all of TikTok to possibly give to me.
Mm-hmm.
On YouTube, I log on to YouTube, and there's a bunch of videos to pick from, and there's some titles and some thumbnails, and it's a selection process. And maybe I click one and I get a little bored and I'm like, never mind, it's not that good. The amount of effort required is a little bit higher to search through titles and thumbnails again,
yeah.
maybe related videos, maybe other videos in your subscriber box to find one you want to spend time on. And that subtle difference is enough to mean the experience shifts between these two platforms. Yeah, TikTok, it's so easy. It's so easy. So, yeah, you know, I don't think Colin and Samir should stop towards trying to get to their 1 million subscriber
no,
goal.
No, not at all.
Mainly because, number one, I talked about vanity metrics before. It's like when they go to do an ad for Jelly Smack
yes.
or something like that, the number one thing that those companies seem to look at is how many subscribers are we going to reach?
This is kind of what I wanted to talk about in here, because while I don't disagree with this person, subscriber count is going to be popular for more than 2 years, because I still don't fully think ad agencies have figured out social media marketing quite yet.
It's slow.
And subscriber count is such a big thing for them to like decide whether they want to do it. Whether it's the right thing, no.
Right.
But it is a thing that they are still actively looking at. It's always the first thing.
I saw a lot more of this in earlier days of YouTube, but there's no doubt a bunch of advertisers that are still doing this where they look towards, all right, I want to do a tech ad. So I want to work with a couple tech creators and we want to just reach, you know, a lot of them, their goal is just to reach as many people as possible, just generally in tech. And the first thing they do is go to the tech channels with the largest subscriber number.
Yep.
And that's the only thing they look at. Now that's, it might work. It's fine if you get to work with those certain select group of creators, but the more nuanced approach is to work with those with the most engaged audiences. There's a bunch more metrics you want to look at. And obviously this makes much more sense now in 2022 when there's a much more advanced study of the creator economy. But the point is, the subscriber number isn't meaningless anymore, but it's a little bit less than the whole picture.
Yeah.
So if you're going to look at, like, I want to run Samsung, I want to run an ad for this phone on as many of these tech channels as possible. I want to work with creators on something like this. I would want to find the ones who at this very moment are speaking to their audiences the best. And that might be a channel with 300,000 subscribers that gets 300,000 views on every video, and not the one with 1 million subscribers that gets 100,000 views on every video. So I guess the point is, it's less important than it has been in the past, but it's just one of a constellation of data points to consider.
Yeah, and if you are still a marketing agency who sees subscribers, like, that still is always, while the algorithm is so great and while somebody watching MKBHD might not look in their sub box and still get served MKBHD videos, that sub box is like a second chance for them to not miss that video. So like, that is double the chance now that this ad gets seen, because that's what you're paying for. So you want to hit the bigger subscribers. I actually think Google Team Pixel does a really, really good job at looking outside the box in terms of content creators, because they do exactly what you said. They'll find a smaller creator that's got 5,000, even 10,000 subscribers. But they'll see that that person is getting 100 comments or like 8,000 views out of their 10,000 subscribers. And that's awesome. That's a really, really loyal community base. And a lot of times when you're an advertiser, that's who you want to hit. Yeah. So it is really important. But those people, because they're not getting the big views and from the subscriber kickoff, like you're saying, are very rarely getting into the algorithm of reaching the outside world of that.
Yeah, exactly. Also, another thing I noticed, this is sort of on a tangent with Shorts and TikTok. We started the Shorts channel.
Yeah.
And I've just been fascinated looking at the graphs of what these shorts are doing. And basically what I found is we had a couple shorts on the channel to start. Then we gave it a big shout out. So this is before it had many subscribers at all. It probably had less than 15,000 subscribers. And those shorts, all of them, I think there's six of them now, all of them have a graph that looks like flat for about 4 days.
Yeah.
And then it slowly starts to increase, where it's basically not hitting the Shorts shelf and getting recommended for 96 hours, and then it does. Right. And then it starts going up. So typically when you have a lot of subscribers on a channel, that graph looks like a spike at the beginning and then it flattens out.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the best combination for a short would be a lot of subscribers and then hitting the Shorts shelf quickly, where you get an initial spike from subscribers to quickly get it into people's feeds, and then the Shorts shelf takes it off. So yeah, it's a combo. It's the 1-2 punch of like having an initial audience who likes what you make and is willing to take that risk and, hey, an investment of 45 seconds of my time, I'll check this one out real quick. And then that data proving to YouTube that it's worth it, it wanting to serve it to more people to get more people satisfied and spending more time on YouTube and serving it up in the Shorts shelf, and then it blowing up. The channel has 160,000 subscribers. All of the Shorts have at least 500,000 views. So they're coming from people who are not subscribed to the channel. That's the interesting thing there. So yeah, that's what TikTok's been good at.
I guess the last thing kind of also is like a subscriber is kind of anytime you enter a like, let's say like Pinterest or maybe like a background like wallpaper app or just like a lot of social media, when you're first joining, it doesn't have any information on you. So a lot of times you'll get that prompt that's like, what are you interested in? Tech, hiking, cars. So a subscribing to channels kind of helps YouTube get your personalized algorithm kind of figured out a little easier. And I'm sure they're always going to be interested in that. Now, that doesn't mean the number of it's that important, but YouTube's not going to get rid of subscribers or anything like that it's helping them so much be able to serve you that information.
Yeah. That just reminded me of something. You remember Google Plus?
Vaguely.
Google Plus was another long ago attempt at a Google social network. And I was one of the earliest people to start using Google Plus. I gave it a shout out on my channel. I talked about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I eventually ended up in the suggestions for who to follow when you first
sign up
for Google Plus. Uh-huh. It was like me, Guy Kawasaki, like some CEOs. Like it was a small list. And I was in there. And so I had a couple million followers on Google Plus, which was great.
You were like the Beyonce of Google Plus.
I was one of the top 10 most followed people on all of Google Plus.
That's
but
awesome.
My engagement ratio was very low because most of those people who just signed up and didn't really use Google Plus mm-hmm. were just following me and never engaged with anything. So if you were looking to do a brand deal on Google Plus and you stumbled across the top 10 most followed accounts, you'd be making a horrible mistake.
Yeah.
Because that would not be a very good use of your money unless you specifically wanted those people's audiences. So if you wanted tech, you should go to the people with the most engaged tech audiences. But yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I had like 5 or 6 million followers on Google Plus, which was not a big social network and not a lot of people used it.
I wish
they
sent you a plaque because that would be a piece of history.
That would have been really funny. But yeah, you know, it died as quickly as it came up. But I do remember being in the suggested list.
That's kind of awesome.
And so if you think YouTube's going to go that way, you know, where they suggest automatically channels to follow, I think what they do now is they suggest topics to follow. And if you follow a topic, then there's a bunch of creators in the topic.
Oh, yeah, they do that thing. Yeah.
And so you can subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. So whenever you open the beauty topic, there's videos from 12 beauty creators.
I remember when PewDiePie had like more subscribers than like the music topic on YouTube. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. So this LinkedIn post, I wish I had more context of exactly where it was. If he's specifically talking to marketing agencies, then I like completely agree with this. There are like so many other metrics you need to look at and see what kind of engagement places are getting. But in terms of just like the average person or even the content creator on here, like subscribers are still super important. And while, you know, showing the numbers and everything is kind of like a bragging point or like vanity number.
Yeah.
It's still pretty important.
Yeah. I think the hottest take in this is that it will be gone in the next 2 years.
Yeah, that I disagree with completely.
Like YouTube's gotten rid of a lot of things that we thought were important, like the dislike button counter. I get it. But every social media site needs a way to follow and show how many have done so.
Yeah. And it does it on reasons. TikTok, and it still is a fairly important
aspect. Yeah, TikTok shows followers. Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think that's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's about it. Thanks for this surfacing this info, and for everybody who's been tweeting at us, thanks for doing that too. We get a lot of our topic suggestions and things to talk about from Twitter, so keep sending
Discord
stuff our way,
and
we appreciate the Discord people. But that's been it for this week. Stay tuned. We've got a really fun one coming up. I know I keep saying that, but obviously it's true. It's true. We got a lot of good stuff coming up. So thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Catch you guys next week. Peace.
Waveform is produced by Adam Molina. We are partnered with Vox Media, and our intro outro music was created by Vane Silk.